It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
Today, we're going to be talking about a subject that's dear to the hearts of many Americans. We're going to be talking about the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, which guarantees us 5 basic rights: freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and freedom to petition our government with our grievances. In case you haven't noticed, in recent years, liberal justices have chipped away at some of these fundamental rights and privileges that we as Americans have always taken for granted. Most noticeably, we have suffered a tremendous loss of religious liberty. This loss of religious liberty jeopardizes our jobs and opportunities and jobs for all Americans who take their faith seriously. Unleashed upon America is an aggressive secular regime that demands a rigid separation of church and state. And this rigid separation of church and state is unevenly applied to religious groups and is mostly used to suppress the rights of Christian believers. Joining me today on the Be the People show, which is heard on radio and podcast, is Alan Reinach. Mr. Reinach is the executive director and general counsel of the Church State Council, which is based in Westlake Village, California. So, Alan, welcome to the Be the People show.
Thank you so much, Carol. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, we are discussing an important topic, and I know that as executive director and general counsel of the Church State Council, that you know what's taking place across America. And one of the things I've heard you talk about is the fact that there are many people of religious faith. Many of them are Christians. Some may be other religions who are losing their jobs because of their adherence to faith.
You know, I'm glad we're going to start the conversation here, Carol, because of all of the religious freedom issues that the press tends to cover in our country and that our listeners are aware of, this is the one that they probably never hear anything about. People of all faiths, you know, our organization is a Seventh-day Adventist organization, and so for many, many years, my bread and butter has been representing church members who observe the Sabbath and are working class, you know, hourly wage workers suffering when they're scheduled, you know, their schedule includes a Saturday. I also represent Christians who are scheduled to work on Sundays and, you know, believe that either they should take the entire day off as a Sabbath or certainly be attending their congregational worship. Since 9/11, we have a lot more cases involving Muslim harassment and that sort of thing. So it does certainly impact people of all faiths.
And so do you mostly focus on the situations where people are trying to do these low-wage jobs and they're being told by an employer, you have to work on a Sabbath or you have to work on Sunday? And if that's the case, I would imagine that very few of those cases reach you, because everyday Americans usually don't complain. They just take it.
Well, it's certainly true that for everyone that calls us, there are probably countless others who either just move on and get another job, or they get fired, you know, something, or they compromise on their faith. And they work a schedule that they really don't believe, you know, that they should work. And so to me, the importance of highlighting this issue is to let people know that there are resources available, that there are laws that protect them, and that, you know, it's important to assert those rights.
And, you know, that's an important issue that's been around for a long time. I tend, you know, to be, I guess, more affected by and to see more cases today where there are Christians who are adhering to their faith principles and they're asked to participate in things such as maybe LGBT Pride Day or something that involves some type of compromise of their core religious principles. And during the time I was at Vanderbilt University, we had a situation where Christian groups were told that they could not have leaders that shared their beliefs, or nor could they impose any type of behavior standards. And so that was how I saw the religious liberty of believers being affected.
Yeah, I remember that Vanderbilt case. There was a similar case here in San Francisco against involving the Christian Legal Society, which I've been a lifelong member of, and that went all the way to the Supreme Court. So, you know, it comes up in so many different situations. There's just so much here to unpack.
Yeah, and the case that you mentioned in San Francisco, that I believe was 2010, the situation in Vanderbilt started in 2012, and because the Christian Legal Society lost their case at the Supreme Court, then it sort of unleashed on other colleges and universities a pattern where conservative Christians found their organizations challenged.
Yeah, and it's still going on today. You're right, 2010. I was just looking up the actual decision here.
Now, the examples that you gave about the individuals that are losing their jobs because of refusing to work on the Sabbath or Sunday, and I know that you say even people wearing a headscarf, and so Muslim Americans are affected as well, or immigrants who are working that may, you know, their religion may require that they wear a headscarf or something that identifies them as belonging to a particular religious group.
Yes, it certainly does. You know, honestly, almost every religious group has some means of expressing their faith in their appearance. You know, some Christians will wear, let's say, a cross necklace, for example, and there was a case out of England involving a someone working for one of the airlines there involving a cross. But, you know, Jewish men will wear a head covering, a yarmulke. Muslim women will wear a headscarf or you know, additional. And, you know, many other religions as well. So I think there's a principle that we need to focus on here, which is it's the idea of equal employment opportunity. Do we really believe in a country where everyone is going to be judged in the workplace on the quality of their character, their performance, you know, how well they do their work, or are we going to continue to decide on other bases that as a society we've deemed illegitimate, bases like race or religion? And I will say, often, issues of race, disability, gender, all of these things are intertwined with religion. You know, the white male Christian, for example, might be treated better than the black female Christian. You know, sometimes it's hard to say, but many times these factors are intertwined because, of course, your identity is based on multiple factors.
Well, do you see the situation as worsening, or is it just, you know, something that's been around for a long time? It's not really worsening, but we're more aware of it.
I don't have any statistics per se. I mean, certainly post 9/11, the EEOC statistics on the number of religion charges filed literally doubled over the course of a few years, where other types of discrimination charges remained pretty static. But there's still such a small segment of the total number of charges. I think anecdotally, yes, we certainly have seen a lot more harassment of people who identify with a particular faith. And of course, our whole climate now is poisoned with this kind of culture war antagonism, and both sides, you know, kind of demonizing the other. I just don't think that that helps. Our office has been inundated, but I can't really draw conclusions from the number of calls that we get for help. Part of that is because we're well known for what we do.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and when I return, I'd like to ask you about federal legislation and what you believe needs to be done, if anything.
Each week, the Be the People show presents interviews with insightful guests from the world of politics, religion, media, and culture. The Be the People show is on podcast. It offers bonus footage. To listen to Be the People online, go to the BeThePeopleNews.com website and subscribe to the Be the People podcast, heard also on the America Out Loud Network.
As we say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
I'm back with my guest, Alan Reinach, and we're discussing religious liberty, church-state issues. And so, Alan, what is happening at the federal level? I know that there are some people who are really concerned about the Equality Act pending in the Senate, and they believe that if this passes, that it will overturn the Religious Restoration Act, and that Christian believers and Americans will have less protections than ever before.
So there's so much going on with this, Carol. So the Equality Act did pass the House of Representatives. It eliminates protections for religious freedom broadly. It's certainly a salvo in the kind of culture war conflict between LGBT rights and religious freedom. And there are advocates on both sides of this war that have staked out what I call zero-sum positions, winner-takes-all positions. There's also a group that has been working towards a kind of live-and-let-live middle-ground position to ensure long-term protections for religious freedom, for religious institutions, and at the same token, then, it would provide protections broadly for LGBT rights. So that competing bill is expected to be introduced. It's been in the works for some time. Neither one of them have sufficient support at this time, I would think, to become law. But I think America is going to be faced with a choice. Are we going to go for a winner-takes-all approach, or are we going to try to find a way to minimize what are very real conflicts between LGBT rights and religious freedom? You know, the case we've all heard about, the baker, Jack Phillips in Colorado. You know, here you have a conflict with winners and losers. You know, you got a baker who doesn't want on conscience grounds to bake a cake for an LGBT ceremony, commitment ceremony, wedding ceremony. And you have a couple who are deeply offended by that refusal, who feel discriminated against and violated and rejected. So they have very deep feelings about all of this. I don't think we're going to be able to find a way to eliminate all such conflicts. You know, we do have very differing beliefs about these things. The question is, are we going to go with one side gets to beat up the other side, Or do we go with an approach that says, well, how can we reduce the areas of conflict and increase protection for as many people as possible?
Well, we know that there is cases, or at least a case before the U.S. Supreme Court that could decide some of this.
Well, this morning, apparently, I'm kind of out of the loop here on the West Coast, but my emails reminded me that the Supreme Court was hearing argument today in the cases to decide whether the Civil Rights Act that protects against employment discrimination, whether the definition of gender, of sex, in that act includes sexual orientation. I think it's unlikely that they're going to agree. I've heard arguments on both sides. I think there are very strong arguments on both sides, very different arguments, but I doubt that the conservative Supreme Court is going to agree. I think they're going to say, no, this is something Congress did not clearly do in the first instance, and if they want to do it, they can, but it's up to Congress, not up to us.
Well, I mean, I think so too, especially the complications involving transgender individuals and the fact that it would involve almost a total rejection of science as we know it, for them to be able to make the case that, you know, this is a distinctive group that should be accorded the same rights as males, females, or people that belong to racial and ethnic groups. So it will be interesting to see how the court actually comes down on this, or whether they will kick the can down the road.
Well, and, you know, an interesting side note here, Carol, because we all think of our civil rights as fully protecting women with men, and, you know, protecting on the basis of sex. But sex was added to the Civil Rights Act by those who opposed it, who thought that by adding sex, it would secure votes to defeat it. So that's a very interesting little piece of historical trivia, that we have protection against sex discrimination in employment because those who wanted to oppose even laws against race discrimination thought that by adding sex discrimination, it would result in defeating the bill.
Yes, my understanding that it was added as a joke and the legislation got passed with that intact. And what it meant, though, was that once you included women, the intended beneficiaries, who at that time were descendants of victims of past and present discrimination, African Americans, they all of a sudden were competing with white women. And then by the early 1970s, you know, you had like five or six different groups covered under affirmative action. So it really did dilute the intent of the 1964 Civil Rights Act.
By today, I think we recognize the principle of equal employment opportunity. But the question, look, most states do not have laws protecting LGBT rights under their discrimination laws. And neither at this point does federal law. So, you know, it remains to be seen what the Supreme Court does. It also remains to be seen whether, you know, how, if Congress is going to be capable of taking this up. If they do as good a job with discrimination as they've done with immigration reform, we could be in for a long wait.
I know, and one of the concerns that I have had is that under the current regime, progressive regime, anyone, it seems that if they are a member of a historically disadvantaged group, that whatever they say carries greater moral authority than anyone else. And so it can, their activism can result in job losses and suppression of rights of other people. And it's very unequal, I believe, when it comes to how some workplace laws and expectations are applied, because I know people that, you know, maybe they don't want to wear a particular color on LGBT Pride Day, or maybe they don't want to participate in all the ceremonies, Yet, if they refuse, they could lose their jobs or they out themselves. And so you have Americans that may be going along with things because they don't feel that they have the right to refuse, even though there's no hatred involved of the other group, but they their faith leads them to not want to participate. In today's environment, there's a high price paid for that.
Well, and that's true. You know, here in California, after Proposition 8, supporters of Prop 8 were vilified and businesses harmed, et cetera. I would just remind our listeners of two separate sets of protections. Number one, in federal employment, constitutional protections like free speech would apply. You can't compel someone to engage in a form of speech in federal employment, especially if it's not really work-related. It's one thing if the speech happens to be really kind of part of your job. But secondly, if anyone has a religious objection, and the kinds of objections that our office has seen, I haven't seen any of the ones you're talking about, Carol. I'm sure they're out there and they're valid. What we see is when there are motivational trainings that are based on New Age, for lack of a better term, gobbledygook, you know, New Age principles. And, you know, we have Christians who object that, you know, this is not consistent with their faith and they don't want to participate in this. And I've had a couple of those kinds of cases come up. It's very important to put your objection in writing as politely as you can, but make it clear that it is based on your religious faith. That triggers a whole set of protections for you. And if you are retaliated against or discriminated against thereafter, you have some strong claims. But if you didn't put it in writing, for all intents and purposes, the employer is going to say it didn't happen. And
that's right.
You know, and that's just kind of, you know, typical.
And it's important, too, that if you think you're being discriminated against and there's a pattern, that you document where you were, what happened, if there were witnesses, and just file that away because it may come in handy someday.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to take another break. And when I return, I want to talk with Alan about some of the issues involving separation of church and state.
You're listening to Be the People. Dr. Carol Swain is the mind behind Be the People News, radio, podcast, and YouTube. Be the People's mission is dedicated to empowering individuals to think independently, understand their responsibility, and believe in their unique ability to make a difference in the world. Check out Carol's work at BeThePeopleNews.com. To invite Carol to be your next keynote speaker, go to BeThePeopleNews.com. That's BeThePeopleNews.com.
We're back on the Be the People show, and we're talking about religious liberty and now on separation of church and state. And we know that today America is not quite the country it was even 15 years ago. And we can say that our nation has become increasingly secular. And there are people that argue that there has to be a strong wall of separation between church and state. And I'd like Alan to talk about the issues involved with separation of church and state. Does our Constitution mandate a strong wall of division between the religious community and the government, state, civil world?
You know, I hope we have enough time for this, Carol, because there's so much misunderstanding on both sides about the phrase in the Constitution has to do with no establishment of religion. And I did a historical research thesis looking at colonial religious establishments and what it was that our founding fathers said no to, that they didn't want to have happen. And it was things like government funding of religion. It was religious tests for public office, taxation to support religion, payment of clergy. There were many different aspects of the colonial religious establishments that the founding fathers said, no, let religion be self-sufficient, let it be independent of government, and let, you know, government and religion stand on its own two feet, let religion be voluntary. Now, some Puritan leaders at that time were alarmed that this would be very detrimental to Christianity. But what they found was that the free market in religion really helped lead to the revival known as the Second Great Awakening, that the competence and quality of the clergy increased dramatically when they weren't, dependent on a government check, when they actually had to be a little more productive and spiritual in order to have a congregation that was willing to support them financially instead of just being, you know, paid out of the city coffers. So the concept of a wall of separation between church and state that Thomas Jefferson coined, he actually borrowed the concept from Roger Williams, the founder of Rhode Island, who was very, very much a devout Christian. So there is a wall of separation. The problem is both sides have taken their hits at it, and it has become so greatly distorted.
Well, I mean, I would agree with all of that. And now that it has become so greatly distorted, what do you think average Americans need to know when it comes to situations where they may be told by someone else, oh, no, you can't do that because of separation of church and state? What situations would you agree that it would be a violation? And when is it not a violation for a person to engage in acting on faith principles when they are going about their everyday life on a job or in a school?
Well, okay, you mentioned schools. So let's start there, because the Christian community reacted very harshly to the early Supreme Court decisions in the 1960s that said, instead of our schools being thoroughly Protestant, really, the schools need to be religiously neutral, and it's not appropriate for teachers, school administrators, to be leading out in prayer and Bible reading, etc. And I think that principle is sound. And in many places, for example, you know, Christian Legal Society has championed the rights of Bible clubs on campuses. And when students get together and engage in their faith voluntarily, it's much more meaningful than when somebody reads a scripture and recites kind of a formalistic prayer over the loudspeaker while kids are passing notes and chatting and doing what they do before the bell rings. You know, that was never a terribly spiritual manifestation of faith. It just wasn't. So the problem was not with what the Supreme Court did. Now, the reaction to that, of course, and to the Christian outrage, is that the schools became very kind of, this is too hot to handle, and they get the idea, okay, religion is not allowed in public schools, and so you have, kind of a consistent litany of cases where teachers are telling students, you can't do your report on what you did on summer vacation about going to vacation Bible school. You know, you can't do a report saying Jesus is my favorite, you know, role model and that sort of thing. Or if you do an art project, paint a picture of Jesus. And these cases come up over and over and over again. It's just plain wrong. So there is a balance where, you know, if a Jewish family sends their kid to school, to public school, they don't want them coming back as a Christian. It's, you know, it's not what they sent their kid to school for. So there's got to be some respect there, and what is the role of the public school?
That's great. You explained that very well. We are coming to the end of the show, but I would like for you, Alan, if you're available, to stick around, because I want to ask you about the Muslim faith and how that's playing out in public schools, but that will be part of the bonus footage on the podcast. And so with the time remaining on the show, I would like, Alan, for you to tell our listeners how they can learn more about your organization and about you, how they can contact you, and if there are any books or materials that you want to recommend that we can link to on the website.
Well, I wish you'd asked me to prepare that beforehand, but our website is churchstate.org, all one word, churchstate.org, and it's easy to contact us through that, to find out about the legal services we offer, to find out about my own radio show / podcast called Freedom's Ring. There's also lots and lots of resources listed on our webpage, other organizations, books and things, our recommended reading list. So, you know, we try to keep that current with lots of good information, articles, etc. So churchstate.org. And Carol, thank you so much for having me on the show today.
Thank you. And don't despair, because we're going to post on our website for the podcast all the contact information. And so for those of you all who are listening on radio, if you'd like to hear more of my conversation with Alan, you can go to the podcast at bethepeoplenews.com or americaoutloud.com, and you can hear the rest of the podcast, and you can also subscribe. And so for those of you all that have been listening to this conversation, you know what I always say, it's up to we the people to be the people who change our nation and our world. Until next time, be the people. I'm back with my guest, Alan Reinach, and in this bonus footage, I promised you all that I was going to ask him about the Muslim faith. And I know that here in Tennessee, where I am based, and in some parts of the country, Muslim students are allowed, you know, to pray in school, that they break up the school day and they allow prayer. Some of them have set up special classrooms. And a few Christian parents have become concerned because they feel like if prayer in school has been out, if prayer in school is something that the Supreme Court has ruled is unconstitutional, you cannot require prayer in school, and if Christians can't pray in school, why is it okay for Muslims to pray, and why is it okay for tax dollars to be used to set up spaces? And that has happened not just in schools, but in other workplaces as well. And so I'd like Alan to talk about constitutionally the Christians that are troubled by this in the public schools. Are they right to be concerned? Is this a constitutional issue that some school districts are ignoring?
So let me give you some historical context. Back in the 1980s, when I was in law school, now I'm dating myself, the Christian Legal Society fought for years, first for passage of the Equal Access Act to permit students to organize Bible clubs that would be on a voluntary basis that could meet in public schools. The bill was passed, and I want to say it was a Supreme Court decision circa 1990 that upheld the act. So the principle that has always been valid, I think, is a principle that the Supreme Court has not kicked prayer or God or religion out of public schools. It has said it's not the business of government, which I think is very much consistent with our founding fathers. So it is certainly, you know, it's good for the goose, it's good for the gander. Christian students can organize their Bible clubs and, get together for prayer, for Bible reading at times when clubs meet. Of course, the issue for Muslim students is their religion won't really permit them to wait until, say, after school hours when clubs may meet. It's five times a day, and I haven't personally handled any of these issues. I'm guessing that maybe two or even three of those times might fall during the school day. So it's certainly an appropriate accommodation of the Muslim faith for schools to find a way to permit voluntary prayer by Muslim students in a way that's not disruptive of other, you know, of classes, et cetera. So I think it is appropriate if the a school is permitting making arrangements for Muslim prayer, but somehow excluding or restricting Christian students, that would be a problem.
Well, it seems to me it would be a problem if you use taxpayers' dollars, given the shortages in school funding, certainly here in Tennessee, to set up special prayer rooms. And I know that's being done in a lot of school districts. And so I don't believe it is being evenly applied. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, everyone can pray in everyone should pray in school or can pray in school, but our Constitution, you know, pretty much has said no. And in some places, people are not allowed to have silent prayers, or if a teacher is caught with a Bible inside of the classroom that they may be reading during their break, they could get in trouble.
There have been excesses on all sides of this issue. I think what people of goodwill, of faith on both sides need to do is build bridges. Part of the problem with these conflicts is they arise in very passionate, you know, overcharged environments where people get backed into a corner. And I think as Christians, we need to be peacemakers. We need to approach these conflicts to make peace, to resolve conflict, and not, you know, not heat them up further. And I think that would go a long way to reducing the incidence of these problems. Do teachers have a right to read the Bible on their breaks? Of course they do. But the more that we as Christians shout that the courts have banned religion from the public schools, the more school administrators are going to believe it and say, oh, well, if religion's been banned, then the teacher can't have the Bible.
Clearly what's happened is that the secularists are very well organized, and the Freedom from Religion group, and they target teachers, and they use their children sometimes to do so. So based on, you know, what I have seen during my years as a university professor, as well as just reading the news, is that there seems to be more of a persecution of the Christian faith. And I think that has to do with the fact that we have been the majority in America. I'm not so sure, you know, if that majority means a lot, because it's easy for people to say they're Christian, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they believe anything in particular. And the number of people who consider themselves, you know, people of faith that go to church, we know that is declining rapidly.
So, Carol, and you know, as I've thought about these issues for many, many years, it strikes me that biblically, hostility to the gospel is to be expected.
Yes, it is. And you know, persecution
is to be expected. The cross is offensive. So the question is not, you know, we should not be surprised to see people taking offense at our faith. The question is, how do we respond? And I think that we need to do a much better job of responding as peacemakers and tearing down the barriers and resolving conflicts. I think there's way too much hostility that we contribute to on our side as well.
First, what I think is that you are absolutely right that the Christian faith was never supposed to be a bed of roses, and that if we're not being persecuted, there may be something wrong, you know, with how we are going about our faith. So it's not reasonable for us to expect not to be persecuted. I think that we as Christians get caught up in the fairness, because in America, we are always looking to see what's fair, and that's that sense of justice that I'm being treated unfairly, this is wrong, that is what causes many people to respond in a way that may be more defensive.
Well, you know, in our legal work, in our brochures, I have always entitled it biblical peacemaking, because I do believe that when there are wrongs, we are called not to do, you know, the natural human response to conflict is fight or flight. So
right.
We're not called to retaliate and you know, oh, we're going to beat you up. You harmed us. You took away our rights. You know, we don't fight back. And neither do we just run away and bury it under the carpet, what I call the big carpet method of dispute resolution, you know, just sweep it under. No, we assert rights, but we do it in a way seeking to resolve conflict, seeking to educate those who have made mistakes, you know, about what they've done wrong and what is right. And I think in that way, we witness for the character of Christ.
I agree with your points there. You had some thoughts about the Supreme Court and ways you think that conservative justices could actually harm our religious liberty. And so in the few minutes that we have left, maybe you'd want to share some of those views about the Supreme Court.
I appreciate that, Carol, because, you know, it's certainly common for us as Christians to see the dangers from the left, from liberal justices who are, you know, certainly ignorant, if not hostile to our religious faith. But the reality is, historically, the conservative justices have actually done more harm to our First Amendment rights. And I'll give you just a couple of quick examples. The 1990 decision written by Justice Antonin Scalia in the so-called infamous Peyote case, it really demolished our rights under the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment that protect our rights to practice our faith. It pretty much rendered it into a nullity and no more than a non-discrimination clause, which is really, a variation of equal protection under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. So that was done by a majority of conservative justices with respect to the Free Exercise Clause, and they have stuck by that ever since. And it was, you know, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was really championed, you know, by Democrats and liberals and signed, liberals and conservatives, you know, broadly. Of course, signed into law by Bill Clinton in 1993. Then we have the Establishment Clause, and what has taken place is, in a sense, the left has said, well, okay, the church has autonomy with respect to the worship service. So they've used the wall of separation to push the church back inside the confines of the church, and when we step out of the church and we minister in society, adoption agencies, hospitals, schools, social service agencies, you know, the left says, well, those are all subject to all the same rules and regulations. You don't get any special treatment because you're a religion. And ultimately, they want to make it so that we even lose the right to hire and fire people of our own faith who are representing our faith in those kinds of services. But what we need to protect our institutions is a vigorous wall of separation between church and state. But on the same hand, conservatives have been seeking to tear it down and seek more and more access to government grants, to government funds, and the conservative justices have gone along with that. And what inevitably is the result is, yeah, we have more opportunity to access government funding, but the golden rule is not repealed. I mean that other golden rule that says he who has the gold makes the rules. So
you're
the
right.
the more that we tear down the barriers to getting the government funds, the more we subject ourselves to the government rules. And the conservative justices have been very much at the forefront of this.
Well, you know something, I don't think that the churches and people of faith really thought through what they were doing when George Bush instituted the faith-based initiative that allowed churches to apply for grants for the social service work they were doing. I always saw that that would be a vehicle that when you got a different kind of president, which we got with President Obama, that the rules would change. And what we saw were some religious leaders who had been on board, more conservative with George Bush, that once Obama was elected, those church leaders jumped ship because they followed the money. And so it resulted in a weakening of Christian organizations in many ways, because there were things that they couldn't do. And there are some rehab programs, for example, drug rehabilitation programs that have been effective because they can give the message of the gospel. But once they're taking federal funds, then they're limited as to what they can say and do.
Which is a tragedy. And I think that that really highlights why we want to have institutional separation of church and state. You know, let me kind of take a step back here, because I think that the biblical model is for the church to occupy the prophetic role, not the role of the priesthood. The priesthood is very much part of the status quo of the establishment. They cozy up to power, and they tend to endorse and defend the status quo of power. And in so doing, the priesthood is incapable, structurally incapable, of calling the society, calling the power structures to repentance and to a higher moral and spiritual standard. The church's calling is to stand apart from power, to speak truth to power, and the society is always going to need to be called to a higher moral and spiritual reality, and that's the role of the church. And so I think, you know, when we think about these issues, the thing that we should do as a church is avoid becoming entangled too closely in politics, and in especially partisan politics. I'm not talking about issues, because yes, we should be advocating our conscience on important issues of the day, but let's not become too cozy with politicians and parties, so that we lose our ability to speak that prophetic truth to power.
Well, right now, you know, it's almost too late. It seems too late, but it's never too late, right? As long as we're living and breathing, because the churches have drawn lines, and the Democrats have their churches they can count on, and Republicans have churches they can count on. And for me, as a Christian, you know, my deciding factor is the party platforms. One party platform adheres more closely to my Christian values, and as a consequence, I throw my energy behind that party. And I guess that also applies to people that make a different decision than what I do.
Well, these are certainly difficult issues to navigate as we try to figure this out. But it's one thing what we do as individuals with politics. It's another thing for how we as congregations and churches do, because, of course, you know, politics in the church has the great potential danger of dividing us into Republican and Democratic churches.
Well, I mean, that's already happened, in case you don't know, out there in California. That has happened across the country. And I have to tell you, I really enjoyed our conversation. You've given us a lot to think about. And I hope you will return and be a guest again on the Be the People show.
Carol, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure, and be happy to do it.
And for you listeners out there, make sure you share this podcast and subscribe to the Be the People podcast, and let your friends and neighbors know about the important issues that we discuss on this show. And remember, it's up to us, the we the people, in the preamble of the Constitution, to be the people who change our nation and our world.